Welcome to the Ancient Christian Writers series, led by Father David Abernethy at the Oratory of St. Philip Neri in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The following recording is a reading and discussion of the ascetical homilies of St. Isaac the Syrian. Our ability to provide podcasts free of charge is made possible by the generosity of listeners like you. If you would like to make a contribution in support of our ministries, please visit www.thepittsburghoratory.org. Your interest and prayerful support are appreciated. God bless you and enjoy the podcast.
Our help is in the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth. Okay, welcome back to the Ancient Christian Writer series, and we're picking up with our reading of St. Isaac the Syrian, his ascetical homilies, and we're currently completing the 15th homily and picking up on page 207, the second full paragraph. And in these last couple of pages, he'll be discussing the difference between silence and talkativeness, of fasting versus gluttony, and solitude versus an over-involvement within an engagement of the world. And so this is sort of the back and forth that he'll be doing in these final few pages of the homily. So we're picking up on page 207 with the paragraph that begins with the word nothing. He writes, "Nothing so coals the fire of that Holy Spirit that the Holy Spirit breathes into a monk's heart for the sanctification of his soul as familiar intercourse, much speaking and association, except it be with the initiates of God's mysteries for the nurturing and amplification of his knowledge. For such intercourse as this awakens the soul to life, uproots the passions, and more than all the virtues, make shameful thoughts vanish. Have none but such men by your friends, or for your friends, and the sharers of your secrets, lest you place a stumbling block for your soul and stray from the way of the Lord." And so, you know, certainly for monks, constant conversation and association with others would be problematic, that they embrace a life of deep solitude and silence. But even in our cultivation of silence in our lives as Christians, again, we want to do such things in moderation. And in particular, I think what Isaac mentions in regards to having greater conversations and spending more time with those who live a virtuous life, that we would be discerning and discriminating in those who we choose to spend time with, that this does have an effect upon us. It can form and shape our worldview, our opinions and perspective on things, and I think we need only look around our culture to see how this kind of indiscriminate exposure to things is affecting children all the way through adults. And so I think if we were to garner some advice from Isaac, would be this, you know, to seek out those who are especially living a humble life, and with them seek to have holy discussions that stirs the greater desire within the heart, inflames the desire for God. He goes on to say, "Magnify in your heart the love that unites and joins you to God, lest the love of the world take you captive, for this is the beginning and end of corruption. Habitation and familiar intercourse with ascetics is a cause for each to be enriched with divine mysteries. But affection for slothful and indolent men leads to insatiable filling of the belly and banqueting with one another. It is an odious thing for such a man to partake of food without his companion. And he says, 'Woe to the man who eats his bread alone, for it will not seem sweet to him.' These invite one another to banquets, and like hirelings repay each other's courtesies. Away from this accursed love, this unseemly and obscene conduct. Flee, O my brother, from those who have become accustomed to do such things and never desire to eat with them, even if necessity should constrain you, for their tables are cursed and is waited upon by the demons. The friends of Christ the bridegroom do not partake of it. And so, you know, a kind of abstemiousness in diet certainly was important for monks, and that they would love fasting more than those who are gluttonous would love feasting. So they would desire to have fasting as a regular part of their lives, where some might rejoice when discipline seasons are over, when Lent is over. For the true monk, that would be sort of a time of sorrow, because they know that through the fasting also comes a deepening of prayer. And so to be in a group of monks where perhaps there are those who don't like to eat alone, and so they use that as an excuse to invite others to join them, and then they begin to extend what they prepare for the meal, rather than, they were pretty strict in regards to even how many different types of food that they would allow themselves to eat in one meal. And so for a monk then to be encouraging others to come to eat with them, and then they would exchange that courtesy, well, I invited you to dinner, well, you should come to my place the next time and we'll fix a meal together. You know, this is why Isaac could say this is kind of obscene conduct for a solitary monk who loves fasting. And it might seem a bit absurd for us to express it in this way, that somehow our eating with others would be obscene conduct. But I think we could see that for those who are living a disciplined life, that to have this strong desire to go out to fancy restaurants all the time and to, you know, be constantly eating meals that are very rich, this is certainly going to have an effect on our spiritual life. That there is a kind of weighing down of the soul that takes place with rich foods. And that's why we would see monks, you know, most often being vegetarians. They certainly weren't eating large amounts of meat, and not rich foods like certain delicacies or sweets. That these things weigh a person down, and I think we've all had that experience, especially at like Thanksgiving, when some people stuff themselves and then everybody's sleeping on the couch afterwards. So I think what we would garner from this would be that we would begin to develop a kind of watchfulness in terms of our diet, not in the sense of being overly concerned about our appearance or our weight, but more so in regards to how this affects the spiritual life, and what it does in regards to what's the sharpness of our mind, and whether it dulls the senses in the sense of being guarding one's thoughts. So if we eat heavy meals or eat them late, we're certainly not going to be able to pray in the evening. Or if we eat heavy meals, you know, certainly again in the morning, we're not going to be able to be humbled in mind and body as we approach our prayer life. And so while we might not limit ourselves certainly as greatly as they do, I think it's still powerful advice for us. You know, we are so used, again, to have this enormous supply of rich foods and take it for granted that, okay, this is a part of our life. You know, cookies, ice cream, you know, brownies, lemon cake, you know, things that that people love, that these things can have an effect upon our prayer life.
Had to pick those ones.
Okay, the last paragraph on the page. Does anybody have any comment on these first two paragraphs, though, before we move on? Yes.
Father, if they're supposed to flee from people who are accustomed to these things, what's to happen to those people? You know what I mean? If they don't have anyone to set a good example for them, why are they supposed to flee from them?
Well, I think, again, he's speaking to those who have, you know, entered into the desert precisely for the solitude, and, you know, that this was a kind of experimental life. You know, they were entering there to do battle with the demons, and so if a person didn't want to be there, or they came there simply to escape the world, or simply to do nothing, that they could be a destructive presence there. And so we don't want to read it in the sense of negativity towards people or that abandonment of people in their spiritual life. But that's not what those who are called to a life of radical solitude are called to. They're not, you know, missionaries to others, and they're not, you know, they don't have this active ministry where they're engaging people, except those who come to them for counsel. But there were monks that would often travel around from monastery to monastery. They were considered the worst kind of monks at that time and could be disruptive because they weren't living in obedience to an abbot in a monastery or living under the guidance of an elder necessarily, that they were following their often their own role of life. And so they could be, you know, a disruptive presence. And even those who would be gathered loosely in these communities, there could be some who would draw the community or, you know, seek to draw others into the things that were satisfying to them. And so even as a corrective, they might be avoided in the sense that, okay, that this isn't what we are seeking to do here, that we're all seeking to embrace this kind of life, and if you're not going to live it, then we're not going to engage you in direct conversation.
And maybe in a way, part of the example is the fleeing. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, that in itself is...
Right. Yeah.
That's even trying as, to apply to
yeah,
us.
Yeah, well, even as, say, as oratorians, that we all agree to live a particular life. We have not only our constitutions but our particular statutes, and we hold ourselves accountable to that. And if a person wasn't going to live that and was living according to his own role, you know, a corrective would seek to be applied. But if he wasn't able to abide by that, even after the most gentle and charitable correction, he would be asked to leave. And it's not necessarily that he is a bad person, but not a good oratorian. Or they would leave on their own. And so I think in the world, you know, that we certainly wouldn't sit in judgment of others in regards to how they're living their life, but we wouldn't expose ourselves to the life of the world to the extent that we would be corrupted by it. You know, there's a difference between engaging others in charity, and it's another thing to be so exposed to their life then that it destroys our own prayer life and our own discipline. And so we, at times we do have to make a choice. Okay. Okay, so we're picking up with the word the monk. The monk who is ever preparing banquets is a laborer for the demon of lust, and he defiles the soul of the humble man. So it's in controlling the appetites, controlling the diet, that one then also humbles the body and also controls the desire of lust. And so to be having banquets, you know, encouraging people to eat beyond what was necessary would be then to encourage the rise of the other appetites. The frugal bread of a chaste man's table makes the soul of him who eats it chaste of every passion. The smell of a glutton's table is the abundance of dishes and fried foods. The foolish and senseless will be drawn to it like a dog to the butcher shop. But the table of a man who continually perseveres in prayer is sweeter than the scent of musk and the fragrance of perfumes. And the lover of God yearns for this as for a priceless treasure. So it's interesting. It sort of turns our, you know, sensibilities on their head. That again, the monk is going to desire just the opposite of what the world desires. That instead of, you know, a banquet table with a great spread, they're going to desire, you know, this humble table, humble bread, and the company of chaste men, because that's what promises a kind of nourishment upon the things of the kingdom, and would avoid the others like the plague. And it's this kind of desire, I think, that we living in the world would want to foster within ourselves. We've talked about this many times before, of speaking of things in regard to desire, that we would desire fasting, we would desire chastity, and come to long for it. And it's only out of that desire then does the discipline begin to grow within us then to achieve it. So a person who desires chastity, loves chastity, is going to avoid the things that either excites the senses, things, you know, that would be, you know, expose them to impure things on, you know, in the movies, television, music, or as Isaac is putting before us, kinds of food or eating indiscriminately that would give rise to lust. And so again, while we wouldn't perhaps embrace it to the extreme, we're called to think about our spiritual life in a conscious way, in an intentional fashion, not again to be think that it can be kind of spontaneous for us, this relationship, but also overcoming the passions. Take for yourself the remedy of life from the table of those who fast, keep vigil, and labor in the Lord, and so raise up the dead man in your soul. For the beloved reclines in their midst, bestowing sanctification, and he transforms the bitterness of their hardship into his ineffable sweetness. His spiritual and heavenly ministers overshadow both them and their holy foods. I know one of the brethren who has seen this with his own eyes. So that one can begin to be nourished, in a sense, upon the grace of God and the holiness of the presence of others, that there is something that nourishes the soul and also frees them from, I think, the imbalanced desires of the body. Tonight at dinner, we were reading from the life of St. Philip Neri, and it talks about how, you know, others desire to be in his presence, and, you know, that they would fear when time for recreation came around that he would order them to go out with others because he wanted to stay in his presence. Or when he would get a haircut, you know, they even began to acknowledge his sanctity while he was still alive. So when he would get a haircut, they would gather up the hair, and once he figured this out, he would throw it out the window, but then they would go down in the street and gather it up. And even when he got sick in the end, you know, he had like this copious flow of blood from the mouth, and they would gather that up as well. So there was something about, you know, his very person, his personality, being in his presence, that was comforting. And especially for those who struggle with chastity, the drawing to his heart that beat in accord with this whole spirit that inflamed it, that by just drawing them to his heart, that they would be comforted but also freed from any unchaste thoughts. And so Isaac, I think, is putting something similar here before us, that to be in the presence of those who are holy should be our desire, and to imitate them in their behavior would be our greater desire as well.
I think it was said of St. Joan of Arc, because of course she was leading an army of men into battle, and of course those would be questioning the appropriateness of that, given that she was, what, all of 16 years old, mm-hmm. or 17. But they said,
said that the effect that she had on them, she actually had the effect of leading men to chastity. Mm-hmm. So it had the opposite effect because of her sanctity than may have been expected.
Right.
I really love this, just this like little phrase, and so raise up the dead man in your soul. There's something, you know, you think about like Christ and his miracles, and then the day with the possessed boy where he said like these can only be thrown out, you know, with prayer and fasting. And there's just something kind of really, I don't know, I really love that little.
Right. We often look for life in worldly ways, things that sort of will excite us in an earthly way, excite the senses, rather than seeking that life within us in the presence of the Spirit. And so there are a lot of dead men walking, as it were, you know, in the sense of the spiritual life, whereas there's the phrase among the Desert Fathers, it's better to die before you die so you don't die when you die. Sort of a tongue twister, but it's better, you know, in regards to the world, to die now in order that we might be born to everlasting life. Okay.
It does cast a new light, too, on the mystery of the resurrection, that that's not just something that we look forward to at the end, the general resurrection.
Right,
God help us when we get there. But that it's something that happens now.
Right, we participate in.
Whether it's Lazarus come out, or a little girl get up, or any of the other.
I think that's what's so beautiful about the Eastern teaching, about the idea of deification, that there is a sanctification that we seek, that we begin to participate in the life of God, and that this, again, isn't something in the distant, but that we are to be seeking now, and that there are those who begin to taste it, and once they begin to taste something of the sweetness of that, or experience the light of it, then they desire it even more. And I think sometimes we can be very functional in our approach to the faith life, in the sense that we fulfill certain obligations, but not with the sense of actually desiring the sanctity of life, or you know, conversion of life, of setting aside the sin. And so we might be dutiful in the sense of going to confession or going to Sunday Mass, but not really desire the life that those things offer us. And it's pretty hard to read the Desert Fathers and come away with that sense, that you know, we have to be in fully and seeking to allow ourselves to be transformed on every level, every sense is to be transformed by the grace of God. Okay, where did I leave off?
Blessed.
Blessed is the man who makes himself deaf to every pleasure that separates him from his Creator, for he eats only one delectable food from the table of the Most High, even that by which the powers of heaven are nourished. Blessed is he who has, as nourishment, the bread which came down from heaven and gave life to the world. For the ages of the new world are sustained thereby. Blessed is the man who in his drink beholds the irrigating watercourse of life that mercifully pours forth from the Father's bosom. For when he drinks thereof, his eye is fixed on him, and his heart will be made glad, blossom anew, and be filled with joy and exaltation. The man who has seen his Lord in his nourishment steals away and partakes of it alone, sharing nothing with the unworthy, lest to be partaken of them by them and be stripped of his beam of glory. But he whose food is mingled with the poison of death cannot partake of it gladly without the company of his companions. The man who has friends in order to satisfy his belly is a wolf devouring corpses. How great is your insatiability, O fool, for you wish to fill your belly with the table of the heedless, whereby your soul is filled with every passion. these admonitions will be sufficient for those who are able to rule over their bellies. So one who's seeking life in God, you know, the eating that is and the nourishment that is going to be most desired is the Holy Eucharist. And all of life will revolve around preparing from that, to move from Eucharist to Eucharist, and that this would be seen and experienced as the most satisfying of all things within the world. And whereas, you know, those who desire the banquets of the world are actually like a wolf devouring corpses. You know, that there is no life in that, in the sense that, you know, the things that we eat, they enter into us and pass out of us, but they aren't life-giving in the sense of eternal life, and yet we often will value them more than we value the Holy Eucharist. People will be thinking more about going out to brunch after morning mass than they are about preparing themselves to receive the bread of life. And the same thing with, like, Saturday evenings, instead of being a preparation to participate in the great banquet of the Holy Eucharist, it's often spent in the banqueting of the world, you know, being out and about, nourishing ourselves upon the food of the world, rather than preparing ourselves to consume the Word made flesh for us, both in the sense of hearing the Word proclaimed and being able to be transformed by that, but then receiving it as our very food and drink in the Eucharist. And so again, hearing things put this way, it challenges us. You know, do we live our lives focused on our preparation for the Eucharist? You know, is that where our minds are on it, you know, from moment to moment? Or do we lose sight of that and become fixated upon satisfying our own bellies? And, you know, we see Jesus warn people about that. You know, when he feeds the 5,000 and, you know, people begin to follow him, and that he acknowledges that there are in the crowds simply some who are looking to fill their bellies, that they don't grasp yet who he is and the kind of nourishment that he's come to offer. You know, he's not an earthly king that has come to fill their bellies. And if that's the only reason that they're following him, then they haven't understood that it is, you know, what that points to that is most important, and that is the Holy Eucharist.
I think the things that are most closely connected to this are typically thought of as like chastity and especially celibacy. But I think the little phrase, for the ages of the new world are sustained thereby, I don't know why I never really made the connection with, like, fasting, not so much in the sense of, like, depriving oneself, but one's only nourishment or need being the Eucharist, in that, as being that same kind of eschatological symbol, like, prophetic witness of, like, the life to come and what that's going to look like. That the, I mean, you know, of course, the heavenly banquet isn't going to be like food like we have here, but, you know, to really see it as that same kind of, you know, witness of the things to come.
Right.
It's really
even
cool.
That by which the powers of heaven are nourished.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that our focus and our desire should be to be able to consume that same kind of food, heavenly food rather than earthly. The next section has to do with the next two little paragraphs, fasting and silence. The odor of a faster is most fragrant, and upon meeting him, the hearts of discerning men are made joyous. But the glutton is stricken with fear when he associates with the faster and devises excuses not to eat with him. And so there is a kind of peace and holiness that is experienced in the one who fasts, one who's been humbled in mind and body. There's a kind of gentleness, a desire, and so one would desire to be in their presence and long to, I think, know, you know, what it is that gives them such great joy. And whereas for the glutton, there's going to be kind of a fear of that, that such an individual would be threatening, that the way that they live their life becomes a judgment upon them, even if never a word is spoken. Simply the fact that they live such a disciplined life and that they love fasting, it's going to make one who is more gluttonous uncomfortable. And so, you know, fasting often will be mocked, or all of a sudden there can be this great concern that a person is being too strict or too disciplined, you know, and so there can be a criticism of the practice, or simply a downplaying of it, you know, that this was, you know, something from, it's more of an archaic practice, something in the past, or done by only by monks. You know, we've talked about this before, that the practice of fasting for us now is before the Eucharist is only an hour. There was a time it was from midnight on, and you know, there are only two fast days, you know, that are obligatory within the year, and then abstinence, you know, once a week, but even that is sort of loosely held, that it can be, you know, supplied by some other discipline.
And even on the two fast days, you still get one full meal.
They're not really fast days.
Smaller.
That's right. It's not really fasting. Yeah, because you're not, the moment you eat, you're breaking your fast. So, since you have that little meal, it's over. So it's, you know, how then is the practicing of regular fasting going to be seen as something joyful or something desirable? You know, those, you know, a glutton isn't somebody who simply, and we've talked about again this before, that it's not the human hog, you know, someone who is, you know, like grossly obese. I mean, I think gluttony can be simply wanting things when we want it, and the kinds of food that we want, and so being in the presence of someone who really does, you know, avoid those rich foods as well as, you know, keep to the regular fast, that, you know, even those who live what seem to be a benign life in that regard, that aren't, you know, grossly gluttonous, are going to be made to feel uncomfortable by that individual.
Yeah. Is it really the, and you may think that it is, or he may think that it is it really the refraining from the more sumptuous food, let's say, about fasting? It seems, what I'm wondering is whether you speak of St. Philip Neri or Isaac. Yes, speak about Isaac. I'm asking myself, what is it about fasting? And how to fast in the right spirit, and how to fast in the moment when it's difficult, because fasting is difficult. It all doesn't always feel joyful. Is it the allowing of space to be created in oneself just by not satisfying oneself, because the glutton or the impatient man or the irascible man is always going after things immediately. It's this sort of movement. Whereas the man who fasts, it seems, in the right spirit, is undergoing and suffering privation within himself. I mean, and that can be in all of his senses. And he allows that to happen. But in that process, that's what creates the space for God to have greater space and dwell in him. Is that...
Right. Well, like, even, like, the little old lady who is very dainty and probably eats very little,
yeah,
you know, she can be, would fall under that umbrella of glutton.
Really?
Like, I have to have it just so, and just this kind of food, you know, very particular.
Yeah.
in what must be had. And so the food itself becomes an end because, you know, it's the object of her concern. Whereas fasting for the Christian is always, there's always this personal and relational aspect to it, that when the bridegroom is taken away, then they will fast. That in the bodily hunger, we are forever now to associate our hunger and desire for Christ and for his love. And it's always now associated, too, with the Holy Eucharist, that the emptiness that we might fill within us, the hunger, then becomes a longing for the love that he alone provides within the Holy Eucharist. That the both fasting now and the Eucharist reshape the way that we look at food. So it's not about the discipline itself. It's the discipline in relation to the coming of Christ, the heavenly bridegroom, and that now all of our senses become, again, what they are meant to be, instruments of communion with the Lord. So the reason why we would constrain and order all of our desires and appetites is because now we are to see behind them, all of our desires, the desire for God, the desire for Christ. And so it touches every aspect of our life. And so fasting certainly is going to be the thing that orders all those things in the most profound way, or that's where one would begin, because it's the fundamental appetite for us as human beings to eat. Okay. Okay. He then goes on to say, the abstinent man's way of life is dearly beloved of God, but his proximity is most oppressive to the greedy. Christ exceedingly praises the silent man, but his presence will not seem sweet to those whom the demons take captive through amusements and distractions. Who does not love a humble and meek man? Only proud men and slanderers who are foreign to his work. So similarly then with silence, that a person who seeks to cultivate that isn't necessarily going to be the most beloved of his community or her community or within the home, that someone who sees the importance of silence and longs for it because of the intimacy it offers with God is, and who protects it, is going to, again, be obnoxious to those who, just by their presence, by those who are constantly seeking amusements and distractions. Because the unwillingness and lack of desire to participate in that can be perceived as a judgment. And then that gives rise to an anger then. You know, they sort of project their own feelings or thoughts upon the other, as the gluttonous would on the faster. And so an anger can stir within the heart. And so that becomes pretty important, that I think one who would be seeking to live both of these, silence and fasting, that there would be kind of detachment from how others might be engaging us, and not to react to that, nor to magnify or look at others through that lens either. You know, we would embrace these disciplines because we feel called by God to do that, and because it affords this opportunity for greater intimacy with him. But if others don't do it or live it in quite the same way, we wouldn't want to fall into the trap of looking at them through the lens of these things.
It seems like you'd also kind of have to know and prepare for the fact that these things, you know, the immense isolation that they would bring as well, I mean, to at least some extent, for whatever length of time. I mean, because if you walk in thinking, if I do these things, then I'll have all these friends who do them too, and that's great. that might not be the case at all. And then, you know,
right.
And then you just like crumple because.
Right. There's an Orthodox monk who lived not too long ago named Seraphim Rose. I think the Russian church sees him as blessed, or acknowledged him as blessed, or at least venerable. He said that, you know, as God calls a person to deeper sanctity, that often he will also isolate them. You know, as he's calling them on to greater holiness, that experience of isolation is kind of a common experience. And so perhaps to expect that becomes something important, that the closer we seek to draw to Christ and to take up these disciplines isn't necessarily going to make us attractive in the eyes of the world or the worldly. And so
more happy perhaps in our own eyes.
That's right. Yeah, because we might experience that isolation in a very sort of deep way, and at times even want to flee it ourselves. It can give rise to a kind of loneliness in the spiritual life where we question our practice, you know, and the way that we're engaged. Right. And that's why guidance from an elder would be so important, why you would see that, because a person might think, you know, I'm on the wrong path because I'm having these feelings or I'm being treated in this way, and so drop the discipline altogether.
It's like that song, "My Only Friend is Darkness." I always just have like a little bit of a laugh when I read that psalm. It just sounds so emo.
Okay, this final little bit is a narration of a certain holy man, about the value of solitude. He writes, "Someone related the following to me from his own experience. On days that I keep company with men, I eat 3 or 4 small loaves of dry bread. And when I compel myself to pray, my mind possesses no boldness before God, and I cannot set my gaze upon him. When, however, I separate myself from them by practicing stillness, the first day with difficulty I eat only 1.5 loaves, and on the second day 1. But once my mind is anchored in stillness, I struggle to eat 1 loaf and yet cannot. Without effort, my mind ceaselessly converses boldly with God, and his radiance constantly illumines me and induces me to behold and take delight in the beauty of his divine light. But if, while I am practicing stillness, someone comes and converses with me, be it for an hour only, then it is impossible for me not to increase my meal, not to fall short of my role, and for my mind not to grow slack in the divine vision of that light. Behold, my brethren, how good and profitable are patience and solitude, and what power and facility they give to ascetics. Blessed is he who is patient in stillness for the sake of God, and eats his bread alone, since he converses with God always. To whom be glory and dominion both now and ever unto the ages. Amen." So it's not eating only bread alone in the sense of food. I think it's where one seeks to nourish oneself in life. And so blessed is the one who eats his bread alone, who seeks that kind of solitude and silence that allows one to be nourished upon the grace of God. And the more one steps out of that and seeks nourishment in the things of the world, the harder it is then to step back into it. That, as you hear him say here, that, you know, if I've become lax and I've turned to those things, then to keep my mind upon God, even when I do have that opportunity for prayer, becomes very difficult. And it's only after a period of time that I regain that. And so, you know, when we look at somebody like Philip Neri, who spent all those hours in the catacombs in prayer, he developed this taste and hunger for that prayer. And as soon as work would be done, he would, you know, go back to a lonely place, often up on the roof, where, you know, he could be alone or you know, back to the catacombs while he was still a young man. But, you know, if we allow ourselves to become dissipated, then you know, our hunger for these things and to nourish ourselves upon bread alone is going to be lessened. We're going to be entertained and fed and nourished by the presence of others and what they can offer us. And one might understand that, you know, but I think one who is seeking a kind of intimacy with God is going to understand that there is going to be a kind of loneliness that is experienced in that silence and solitude, and that we don't want to run from that in order to nourish ourselves upon entertainment or engagement with others, because we feel that emptiness. We want to allow Him to fill it for us. And so when we experience that, we should draw even closer to Him rather than, as we often do, run to other things. Because think about it, we can, you know, at the end of the day, we might feel spent and empty from, you know, our labors for the Lord or our prayer disciplines. And so in the evening, we might gorge, snack our, you know, or on food or on other things, you know, television, movies, you know, to escape that feeling rather than to turn to Him in that emptiness and allow Him to fill it, allow Him to nourish us in the way that He desires. It's hard. We can even be conscious of that fact and not want to do those things and still do them out of habit.
What about to avoid those things, you retreat to sleep? You know, sometimes for me, that's just the easiest way to stay away from food. And I kind of almost count on the Lord. If there's something you want to tell me, He often speaks to people in dreams, but I don't know. Like, sometimes I feel like a glutton for sleep because that's like my retreat, you know, to keep from engaging in, you know, this endless television or computer stuff or whatever.
Well, sleep can be another kind of nourishment. Another kind of nourishment where we can be gluttonous, or it can be an escape. For example, a person who's depressed can, you know, sleep for forever. I mean, they go down, and it's a way probably that, you know, that the mind allows them to rest from whatever's causing the feelings of depression. And so I think even there we have to be careful, you know, to keep that in an ordered fashion and to seek to develop the disciplines that we need in the other areas, not to escape them by escaping consciousness.
It makes
it
so much easier.
It makes sense.
You're like, well, I got nothing to stay awake for. I gotta go to bed.
It makes sense. If I sleep 16 hours a day, I'm not going to be eating.
12-hour eating fast, you say? How about 11 and a half hours of sleep?
But, you know, so the value of solitude, I think it's a hard thing for us. We're communal beings, and this has been disrupted by sin, and so the thought that somehow that would be healed by solitude, that solitude becomes necessary for intimacy, not only with God, but becomes necessary for true intimacy with others. And so even, say, take, for example, married couples, that, you know, for true intimacy to exist there needs to be a kind of solitude that allows them to enter into this intimacy with God and allows them also to approach each other in a kind of thoughtful, self-aware fashion. They aren't meant to cling to each other sort of in a kind of unhealthy way, or where it becomes idolatrous. You know, where, you know, God again is pushed out of the picture, and it's only then, you know, if they have this solitude, then that even kind of healing can take place within the relationship. But it's not solitude like a fierce silence where they avoid each other, so don't get me wrong there either. It's this, a solitude that allows that intimacy with God, that then, and one emerges from that to enter back in to that relationship with the other.
I think we see in a lot of this, it's sort of like Isaac is expanding on what Cassian said, which kind of sounded pretty harsh, but then over time you just begin to understand it and are able to kind of take it. Just like everything you give to the body, you steal from the soul. And it does sound pretty harsh, you know, like everything, but you kind of do. Like, you need nourishment, and if you give it this much to the body, you'll only have this much left for the soul. If you nourish the body to capacity, you won't have anything left for the soul. Like, you need rest. If you give all possible rest to the body, you'll just have nothing left. Like, right. So it's really interesting. Like, and then it does give this sort of like wonderful positive thing, because it's almost like your abstinence in one way is like saving up room or time for the soul, which is really great. But it's
well,
yeah.
You know, think about, you know, where we see ourselves in constant communication with others now, and there's sort of this hunger and desire for it, you know, where we can't stand solitude. And yet the effect of that has led to a kind of isolation, that people feel more alone now than they ever had, even though we have this, you know, instant communication with each other, that there is a lack of intimacy. You know, that becomes easier, you know, it's sort of like junk food, you know, where we feed ourselves quickly on it, but it's not something that's deeply satisfying to us. And in the end, it, you know, can't sustain itself, and it won't nourish us, because we don't have to work for it. You know, we just do this quick kind of communication, but it doesn't involve really the gift of self to the other, or vulnerability. In fact, there is a kind of protection and barrier that's put up between the other when it's all takes place via electronics. It's much harder to be in the presence of others and to see their, you know, irritating, you know, little behaviors and things like that.
Why'd you look at me?
You're paranoid. See, that's what happens when you communicate only through electronics, and somebody looks straight at you. It's like they're thinking the worst of you. What are you looking at? Don't be eyeballing me. So. But this is a pretty hard thing, you know, so the thought of wanting solitude, and think in a relationship, that could be pretty threatening. You know, somebody could, you know, be threatened by God too in a relationship, that somebody would want to withdraw into silence and prayer, and that somehow that in their mind makes them less important in the eyes of the other. I was reading the writings of, her name is Concepcion or Conchita. I think
it's Conchita Concepcion something.
De Armida. Have you ever heard of her? She was a Mexican.
Armida.
A Mexican woman, mystic, married and had children, and but she had this deep love for the Holy Eucharist, and her husband, when he married, knew that she had this deep love, and, you know, had this desire for daily Mass and to spend time for the Lord. And so, like, on the wedding day, he makes this announcement that, you know, that he is going, he knows that she, this is important for her, that she's going to go to daily mass, that he's never going to become an obstacle to that for her. And even when he was dying and on his deathbed, you know, the first thing that he would often ask her when he would see her is that, have you received the Holy Eucharist today? And, you know, eventually he dies, and then she goes on to embrace a more of a kind of religious life that then flowers into this, you know, deep love for, in particular, for the Holy Eucharist and a number of religious communities. She helps to found a number of religious communities, but all in a very important time. She lived during the time of the Revolution, where, you know, the church was in a bad state, but also, you know, religious communities were being suppressed and priests were being killed, and all in the midst of this great, you know, Eucharistic devotion was developing. But getting back to this point, you know, her husband knew that was important and wasn't threatened, you know, by her retreating to that solitude to be with the Lord, that, you know, wasn't a threat to their relationship.
It's so romantic.
Should be used in marriage prep.
Oh, yeah. Seriously, that's so beautiful.
If you can't find a person like this, don't get married. Just say no. Wow, that, I was going to say let's start homily 16, but we're almost at 8:30. Yeah. And so I think it would be good for us just to pick up there, which he just begins to talk about renouncing the world and what that really means, how it is that we understand the world. And so we'll pick up there next time. Okay. So when we close, as always, with the prayer our Savior taught us. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. And the Lord be with you.
And with your spirit.
May Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Go in peace.
Thanks be to God.